Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another one of these interviews I'm doing. I'm welcoming back Caleb Maupin, who is a very interesting left-wing commentator, a friend of this channel, and someone I watch fairly regularly. I asked him what he wanted to talk about, and one of the things he suggested, given that he's been in the news recently for his connection with Jeffrey Epstein, was Noam Chomsky, who's an interesting figure. I mean, I think like basically everybody else, I read Manufacturing Consent many years ago, and I thought, well, there's quite a lot of interesting and true-seeming things in there. But I also, in the back of my mind, remember he had a famous debate with Michel Foucault at some point as well. But aside from that, I don't know much more about Noam Chomsky. But before we get going, where can people find you, Caleb?
Well, I've got a website, Caleb Maupin Books. .net, CalebMaupinBooks.net. So that's, and also my organization is called the Center for Political Innovation, CPIUSA.org.
Right. And I'll just remind people they can pick up courses at the academic agency, Buy It Now, Trivium, many other courses available. So where do you want to start? I mean, before we even get into Chomsky, the Epstein files, obviously a huge story. I, in recent weeks and months, think that unfortunately MAGA has been in the process of, I see it in terms of the iron law of oligarchy, in terms of like, you know, what was authentic and dissident and radical and exciting about MAGA has started to drain, as it seems like, you know, a movement that was predicated on draining the swamp is kind of in the process of becoming, or now is, just like defense for all of this. How has it been playing out there? On the right, on the left, do people care? I mean, in this country, they're trying to say that Epstein was a Russian agent, you know, as we're recording this.
Well, I do think that there's a layer of people in America that you can call the dissident MAGA, the people that were in the Trump camp but are disgusted by his foreign policy, that are fans of Marjorie Taylor Greene, Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson. They are the most important constituency in America right now. I've just gotten back, just last night from Minneapolis, and I'll tell you, the left is lost. The organized political left is completely controlled. And a lot of the MAGA elements that are just kind of cheering for the ICE raids and all of that are completely controlled. But there is a very significant, and I'm convinced it's pretty big. I think Elon Musk has got a lot of bots on Twitter trying to make it look otherwise. But I think it's a very big percentage of Trump supporters that are not on board with his foreign policy, that are opposing Israel. And Epstein is really a line for them. And that's who I would like to reach out to. I think that they are the future of the dissident MAGA, because at this point, Trump has really just betrayed everything he promised, you know, to protect free speech. Well, not if you disagree with Israel, to end foreign wars. Well, he's threatening Iran, you know, kidnapping the leader of Venezuela. And I think that layer is really important. I got to tell you, I was in Minneapolis, and it's apparent to me that there's some kind of intelligence operation, that Somalia is a really, really geostrategic country. It's on the Horn of Africa, right across the ocean from Yemen. You know, China's only overseas military bases in Djibouti, which is right on the Horn of Africa as well. And it over the past 10 years, one particular state, Minnesota, has just brought in over 80,000 residents, people from Somalia. And they've gone to Minnesota, and it appears they were funneling huge amounts of money, about $9 billion, a lot of it back to Somalia. And I look at this and I see intelligence, and it looks like Trump has sent ICE out there, and they're supposed to be enforcing immigration laws and going after criminals, but they're there to kind of make people miserable in the area where this Somali population is concentrated. And the Democratic machine has mobilized its base to protect the Somalis there and to set up. I mean, they have kind of a police state of their own. I mean, just being out there and reporting was a nightmare. You'd set up on the corner and I'd start filming my stand-up, and one of these people would run over. Are you a conservative? Are you Fox News? And then if you didn't give them the right answer, they'd start blowing their whistle and making a scene and chase you out of there. I mean, it was frightening. And this is deep state on deep state stuff, if there ever has been. And we need to put the Epstein files release in that context. There's a fight within the American ruling elite. You know, my whole thing about what is a counter gang and Bonapartism and all of this. The American intelligence apparatus, the American deep state, is at war with itself right now. They have conflicting agendas. And amid all of this, we need to find out how we can build a movement to actually work in the interests of the working families of America against the globalist imperialist system. And if we see an opening, we got to take it. But it's not easy. And I mean, I think this Minneapolis stuff, I was just there for a week and a half. There's no opening for, I mean, it's a lose-lose, right? I mean, ICE is certainly not what anyone who's opposing the police state and wants freedom wants. But at the same time, the people opposing ICE are very, very controlled. And it's like they're defending intelligence. They're defending imperialism. They're defending some kind of U.S. imperialist operation in Somalia. And it's complicated, but it's a mess. And it's kind of a lose-lose.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I've been wanting to do is that in this moment where you say, you know, both sides are controlled, is, you know, I've been saying recently I'm sensible center left, but part of the reason for that is because I think the future, Caleb, for any positive change is going to have to come at something like this intersection. You know, on the broadest level, it's the intersection between I don't know, like Tucker Carlson and a pro-Palestinian activist or something like this. Like this, you know, people who see the regime for what it is and have actually got into a space somehow beyond traditional blue hat, red hat, or left versus right politics, which I see. I mean, I've just written an article called Activating Agent Smith, which was, you know, written 1 week after an article called Escaping the Slop Right Matrix. But at the end of that, I said, look, imagine a person, imagine a man who's bringing on this performance. He's got a sock puppet on one hand and a sock puppet on the other hand. And then in the performance, he gets the right hand to attack the left hand. Okay. And it's like these people are asking me to cheer on this sock puppet. And I'm saying, look, it's a bloke attacking his own hand with a sock. You know, that has to be our reaction. And there are people, Caleb, who get that, leftists who get it and rightists who get it. And there are people who just cannot get that. And what I would like to see is a coalition or some sort of thing to emerge from those people who get it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, during the Palestine upsurge, I went to many of those rallies to cover them, you know, for international media and such. The obvious message of the Palestine movement should have been, why are we spending billions of dollars to aid this country called Israel when our bridges are falling apart? You know, the bridge that collapsed, the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Maryland. I mean, why, when we can't purify our own water, when our bridges are falling apart, when our education system is a wreck, why are we spending billions of dollars on this foreign country that is committing crimes against humanity in the Middle East, right? That should have been the message. But that wasn't the message. The Palestine rallies were completely wokeified. Their message was more or less, America is an evil racist country full of evil racist white people, just like Israel. Fuck you. That was their message, you know, and it was, you know, the drums and the faces covered up and this foreign flag everywhere. And to everyone who wasn't part of like kind of leftism, it just looked like a hostile, angry foreign mob. And I think that that was done intentionally. And I think that the Palestine rallies were intentionally done in a way to alienate them from the American people. Why not just frame it that way? Why does the American government give billions of dollars to Israel and they give their people free health care and we can't have health care over here for our own people, right? I mean, it's just pretty obvious. But rather than framing it that way, it was like the Palestine rallies were done in a way that was, it was almost like designed to push Trump supporters to support Israel. It was, you know, and, you know, I know the Answer Coalition is very, very well funded by a billionaire named Roy Singham, who I guess is pro-China. And he arranged for billions of dollars to go into the Answer Coalition and the People's Forum so that they could run these rallies. And I also know that the bigger section of the pro-Palestine protest was run by Jewish Voices for Peace. And they were the ones that did these very dramatic things, like they went into Trump Tower and got arrested. They went into the U.S. Congress, and it was arranged for them to go into the Congress and get arrested. And Jewish Voices for Peace is a wing of Democratic Socialists of America. And that's been, you know, CIA for a long time. And look, at the end of the day, and this is the contradiction with the Palestine protests, was that, especially at Harvard, right? You know, if you read Brzezinski and his writings, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, these schools serve an international purpose for the United States, right? This is where people from around the world come to the United States, and they get groomed to be business partners and allies of the United States. And they really, really need people from the Muslim world to come to Harvard and to come to Yale and to come to Columbia and see that in America, we have room for Muslims. Sure, the American government supports Israel, but look, we have huge protests against it. Muslims pray and all that. It's really, really important for the relationships of the United States to kind of almost put on a Potemkin village, so to speak, and make the United States look more inclusive and more open-minded in order to solidify those international relationships. But Harvard in particular, there are so many Jewish donors and so many ultra-Zionists on the board that, like, Harvard, its hands were tied. Like, they had to crack down on the protests when that was ultimately hurting their ability to serve the foreign policy purpose that they serve. Look, for a long time, there was a communist bookstore right near Harvard University. And there, I think still you have the Center for Marxist Education, which is like a block away. And if those institutions weren't there naturally, the CIA would put them there because they want students from China and Vietnam to say, look how open and inclusive America is. We have a communist bookstore right here near Harvard, right? That those schools serve that purpose. And Brzezinski talks about the purpose those schools in the serve in the opening of his book, The Grand Chessboard. He talks about how the Ivy League schools are really, really important for these international relationships. And they couldn't serve that purpose because the Zionists were just so offended by anyone disagreeing with them. And they had that doxing truck driving around Harvard with people's faces on it. And it's funny because I fit Noam Chomsky into what I'm describing here, this kind of manufactured and controlled opposition. That's what he's always been. And a lot of Noam Chomsky's bios,
Sorry to interrupt you, Caleb, but I should mention that part of what you've been talking about has been somewhat exposed in this country. I don't know if you're aware of her. There's this Palestinian doctor called, I always forget her name. It's like Dr. Alawan or Dr. Let me see if I can pull up her name. But her name's Dr. Aladwan. She's been arrested. She's a Palestinian national, okay, living in Britain. She's a doctor. She has been arrested. Her house has been raided 4 times. The tweets that she's made, okay, because she keeps on using a particular phrase, a phrase that I cannot repeat lest, you know, I get a knock on the door. Right. But anyway, she has been arrested 4 times, and obviously she is a Palestinian nationalist for the pro-Palestine cause. She has now been exiled from the pro-Palestinian cause by the leadership for anti-Semitism, okay? And she's saying, like, hold on a second, this is a movement for literally my people, and it's being controlled by the people that we're ostensibly fighting against. So this is like a very real issue that is going to come into head within the kind of pro-Palestinian movement of this country. So, yeah, so anyway, why don't we get on to Noam Chomsky? He obviously was in the Epstein files. And one of the interesting things about the Epstein files has been the extent to which all sorts of people, regardless of their outward politics, Noam Chomsky was meant to be a socialist, a communist, right? Peter Mandelson, right, is a grandee of the Labour Party, Tony Blair's new Labour Party. He was one of the key people, and there's a big scandal here now, okay? But there are also bankers of all sorts, libertarians, right wingers, conservatives, all in contact and in the same social milieu as Jeffrey Epstein. Why they kept on emailing him while he was still in jail is anybody's guess. But so this is the context for why we're talking about Noam Chomsky now. But anyway, I cut you off. Let's continue.
No, in a lot of Noam Chomsky's bios, they will name him as the most quoted source in the English language after the Bible. That will be, he'll be referred to that. I don't think he's that anymore, but he was at one point in like the 1980s. And the reason for that was because he was quoted in Soviet media, and they would disseminate the quotations from him all over the world. And he was kind of assigned that job in the 70s and 80s. They made him the American intellectual who would give voice to the critiques of U.S. foreign policy that were being made by the Soviet Union. He was not pro-Soviet. He considered the Soviet Union a dictatorship, and he repeated all the standard talking points, but he would give these kind of very dull lectures saying that, you know, hey, the USA commits human rights violations also. And, you know, he was this famous linguist. Linguistics is his background. He doesn't come out of sociology or political science or international studies or anything like that. He comes out of linguistics. And he's from like a very, very kind of wealthy family and a prominent leftist family. And out of nowhere, kind of, he was just kind of selected to be the big name American intellectual who would be quoted in the Soviet media and translated into many languages around the world and would appear internationally to kind of be the voice of opposition to U.S. foreign policy. And that's the role that he's played. And, you know, he's not... The thing that is quite interesting to me, I mean, he's not an activist, right? He was never the leader of any organization. He's just this kind of linguistic academic who got this gig and became the token leftist. And it's interesting to see the response that a lot of people have, because there's a lot of people that are just really upset at the criticism of him. And it's because he was the only one you can find. When I first got interested in socialism and communism as a teenager, like after 9/11, I remember I actually printed out, I found like a Wikipedia list of American communists, and I went to the Barnes & Noble or Borders bookstore, you know, and the woman behind the counter with like an ear piercing or whatever, you know, or a nose ring or whatever, I started reading off the names. The only one they had in the store was Noam Chomsky, and I got to that, and she was just like, oh, we got that guy, and she took me over to the section, and there were like five or six Noam Chomsky books on the shelf, and you know, for a lot of people who'd never encountered leftist critique of U.S. foreign policy, what he was saying was very, very obvious, but at the same time, no one was saying it. And I mean, you probably remember those years just as well as I do. Like, nobody was coming forward and saying, hey, the USA has committed crimes against humanity too. You know, the USA, and I look back on it now and it's like it was done in a very, very, you know, it's not the most coherent or engaging material. And it's kind of obvious what he was saying, right? I mean, it's true that the USA has carried out coups and overthrown governments and all that. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to say that, but no one was allowed to say that back then. There was kind of this consensus that American media didn't talk that way. And he was like the one voice who was assigned to say it in this kind of very kind of dull way, and he would give these lectures, and his lectures and his presentations were not activism oriented. And whenever people would say, so what do we do about it, you know, he would respond with, well, I'm not here to tell you to do anything about it. That's not the role that I play. Kind of he's an interesting figure. And again, it's this kind of controlled opposition where someone's assigned the gig, so to speak. Now, when it comes to Epstein, the main thing people have pointed out is that as this very, very prominent intellectual who's been selected to be the voice of criticism of Israel, Noam Chomsky opposed the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And that had huge value for Israel to have this, the most famous leftist activist who opposes Israel, telling people, don't boycott Israel. Just don't do it. It's not worth it. Not worth your time. That was invaluable.
BDS, right? BDS, yeah. Is it become known, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And he became, that was his role, is he opposed BDS, right? Saying that it wasn't helpful, that it wouldn't work, and for kind of vague reasons. And he kind of played the role of a gatekeeper. The other thing is that I noticed they're over the years, they roll Noam Chomsky out. They just kind of roll him out when there's something going on the left that they don't like. For example, after the film JFK came out, right? Oliver Stone made the film JFK. They rolled out Noam Chomsky to say that there was nothing to see there, that the JFK assassination, and he didn't make arguments about whether or not there was a conspiracy to kill JFK. He just made arguments that, well, Kennedy was an imperialist. He did the Bay of Pigs invasion. He started U.S. involvement in Vietnam. So, you know, there's no point in discussing this. And it's like, well, there are divisions among the elite. Like, you know, I mean, it's not about Kennedy being a saint. It's about the fact that a section of the government didn't trust him, possibly, and that there was a wider conspiracy. But they rolled him out to just say, do not investigate, you know, the assassination of JFK. Because the problem is capitalism. It's not Kennedy and being good or the people that oppose Kennedy. End of the story. And he was like that with 9/11 Truth also, right? As soon as 9/11 Truth got going, they rolled out Noam Chomsky to say, well, that's ridiculous. That's crazy. I think at one point he made the argument, it's racist. Oh, you know, I mean, can't Arab people do something like 9/11? You're saying only white people can, you're racist, you know, and he was there to control that narrative also. And again, mm-hmm. he has this credential. He's the most famous voice of leftism. Why? Because he was selected for the job or something. I mean, it's very weird. And he comes out of, I mean, he's at MIT. And it seems like this is a case of kind of controlled opposition, if there ever was such a thing. I think it's quite interesting. He would always call himself an anarchist. You know, he was an anarchist. He was so much more radical than communism. He was an anarchist and all of that. But if you looked at his positions, he's a social democrat, right? When it comes to classical anti-capitalist leftist theory, you have three categories, right? You have Marxism-Leninism or communism, which is a struggle to seize political power. They want to seize control of the state, right? You have social democracy, which is the idea that capitalism gradually turns into socialism over time, the sum of reforms, the movement is everything, the goal is nothing. And then you have like a wing of anti-capitalism that said, well, we don't want state power to be involved. We want to create socialism without coercion. The idea is that, well, the capitalist state will just kind of deteriorate on its own and we'll create cooperative structures, you know, or we'll engage in terrorism or we'll somehow create socialism without coercion. That is what an anarchist or an anarcho-communist believes, is that they're not struggling to seize political power. They're not gradually reforming political power like social democrats. They're rather going to somehow create communism without any state coercion involved. They're kind of rejecting politics entirely. That's not what Noam Chomsky believes. He's a social democrat. He believes capitalism will gradually be reformed into socialism. And whenever he called on people to do things, it was to vote for the Democratic Party. It was to support the existing labor union bureaucracy. He's not an anarchist. He's a social democrat. But he claimed this, like, I'm an anarchist. I'm for pure workers' democracy. I'm for all of this. It was just like a way to make himself sound radical. And I thought that was very, very odd as well. Like, and a lot of his like grandstanding about he wants something so much more radical than the Soviet Union. He wants pure workers' power. It's all just kind of grandstanding because at the end of the day, what he actually advocated, you know, over and over and over again was called social democracy. It was just social democracy. And his criticisms of U.S. foreign policy, I remember like after 9/11. He had a book called 9/11 that was everywhere and what did it say? It said that the USA has committed acts of terrorism too. If I remember, like, one of the lines from the book was after 9/11, people said that New York City looked like Beirut, but Beirut also looks like Beirut. And it's partially because of American policy that Beirut looks like Beirut. You know, it's like, is this like deeply profound stuff? You know, I mean, it's like silly. Like, I mean, it's like, you know, Michael Parenti, right, who just died, was like the radical alternative to Noam Chomsky. And it was almost like, you know, like Chomsky was there to prevent you from seeing Parenti. Michael Parenti also came out of the Ivy League schools, but he was a hardliner. He was on the national board of the Communist Party that was aligned with the Soviet Union. And he presented a pro-Soviet, full-on anti-imperialist line. And Noam Chomsky was there so you didn't see Parenti, almost, right? Like, it was like, and that this is the game that's played. It's like, you know, if you look at how these things are operated, like, a lot of what American intelligence does is handle the narrative. right? It's like there's an the understanding was almost like there's going to have to be somebody. All over the world, people are critiquing U.S. foreign policy and you know, saying it in Soviet-aligned ways or whatever. So we need to give voice to that. We need somebody who could go on NPR and PBS, public broadcasting or whatever, and be the voice of that. But we need to make sure they do it in a way that's not too exciting and not too coherent. And we can say, look, that voice has been represented. And that's kind of the role that Noam Chomsky played. The other thing that I've noticed about leftism is that there's kind of like an aristocracy. So Noam Chomsky is very close to Amy Goodman, you know, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And he's very close to her. And there's Jill Stein, who was like the Green Party candidate who ran against Hillary Clinton and you know, has run in the elections. And that there's like a layer of people there. They're not really involved in activism. They're not organizing protests. They're not in part of any leftist group. But whenever the establishment needs like a Marxist or a communist, it finds them. And it just, you know, here you are. Okay, you've got your Marxist. And that's Amy Goodman. That's Jill Stein. That's Noam Chomsky. They all tend to be quite wealthy, and they all tend to be Jewish ethnically, and it's kind of interesting. And they come from families that do this. You can say the same thing about Naomi Klein. She's a similar figure, right? And they're kind of like almost on call. Like, you know, if the ruling elite of the United States needs to have, you know, give voice to these sentiments among the broader population, there they are. You've got them. It's quite interesting to explore where they find them and why they are not part of any like movement, so to speak. They're just kind of on call. You know, it's kind of like, you know, an actor. You know, you have your call. Oh, time to get on the stage, and that's kind of the role that they play.
Out of interest, were any of these people Trotskyists, Trotskyites?
Well, that's interesting. Now, I don't know. I know Naomi Klein's parents quit the Communist Party of the United States and fled to Canada because they didn't want to fight in World War II, and they didn't agree with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact when Stalin signed the non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. And they fled to Canada. And Naomi Klein has just been this well-known, you know, Marxist, and she's like the voice of leftism in a lot of cases. She wrote the Shock Doctrine and all of that. She was kind of the go-to intellectual for the anti-globalization movement. Amy Goodman, I know her family are from Long Island. Her parents have like a communist connection or something, but, you know, they were not in the party or whatever. And the other thing I've noticed, though, I mean, as far as Trotskyism, I don't know of any direct connection. Chomsky would always fancy himself to be an anarchist. Amy Goodman doesn't seem to have any ties to any ideological tendency. I noticed that Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, during the Obama administration, they dramatically shifted. They were always like critics of U.S. foreign policy, but they echoed U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, but they echoed the Qatari line, Qatar, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that's where Al Jazeera comes out of. And in the Middle East, the Muslim Brotherhood has long been an ally of the United States. The Muslim Brotherhood is not a leftist organization in any conceivable way. They believe in capitalism, and they will even say things like America is more Muslim than the Muslim countries. In America, you know, we have the free market, and that's, you know, that's in line with the Quran. And, you know, they almost call them westernized Muslims. But the Qatari monarchy, Turkey, there was kind of an axis around Al Jazeera that had the line of like opposing Israel, but definitely opposing the Syrian government, definitely opposing Gaddafi, wanting to negotiate with Iran, but not liking Iran. And that was Noam Chomsky's line. And that was Amy Goodman's line. And that was also the line of the major Trotskyite organization in the United States, the International Socialist Organization that runs Haymarket Books. And that line of the Arab Spring line, that was the Muslim Brotherhood line, that was the line that they were espousing. And I remember my interaction with Chomsky, my one encounter with him where I spoke to him directly was at the United Nations when the Arab League invited Noam Chomsky to speak against Israel, at the United Nations. And I asked Noam Chomsky about how Israel had assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists. And I jokingly, you know, if you watch the clip, he answered my question with the four D's of dodgeball: dip, dodge, duck, and dodge. Because I said, is this not a crime to murder peaceful nuclear energy scientists, by Israel? And he said, well, Why focus on just one crime? Every time the USA threatens the use of force, that's a crime. And he just went on a whole rant about how there are all these crimes committed and all these violations of the UN Charter by Western powers all the time. And I'm thinking, why? But he knew what he was doing, right? He was invited there by the Arab League, which was at that point opposing Iran. He, as a favor to them, he was not going to give me my soundbite saying it was wrong to kill the Iranian nuclear scientist. So he knew how to answer my question in a way where he didn't give me a soundbite condemning what was very much an obvious U.S. crime, which was the fact that, you know, Mossad teamed up with the MEK terrorists and murdered these peaceful nuclear energy scientists in Iran. And I thought that was like skilled on his part. He knew how to give me an answer that wouldn't be quotable, right? But he also, like, he was there very much working for the Arab League, working for, you know, the U.S.-aligned Arab states who were paying him to come to the United Nations and grandstand against Israel. And Amy Goodman was there with him on the stage. She was just there to accompany him at that event. And I noticed they followed the Qatari line. They were very much, you know, and Chomsky would say weird things. Like during the Syrian war, he said that the USA was more afraid of the revolution against Assad than of Assad. And so the USA wasn't really supporting the overthrow of Assad. That's ridiculous. That's you look back on that now, and that was his claim. Well, the revolution, the people's power of this, you know, CIA color revolution against Assad is such a threat to the Western elite that you know, they don't really want to see Assad fall. That's an absurd claim. And that's what he was putting out there. I mean, it was bizarre. So
while we're on this topic, Caleb, it's a little digression, but it's just something that I've wondered about. The Zionists have massively hammered Tucker Carlson with the accusation that he's working for Qatar. So I was interested to hear you say that. Do you think there's any truth to that? Like, do you see Tucker Carlson aping the Qatari line currently? Like, do you think he's secretly working for this Muslim Brotherhood and so on? Or is there nothing to it?
Well, I see Tucker Carlson's foreign policy stuff doesn't match theirs. He's criticizing Israel, and it's probably, I mean, they may boost him or amplify him, right? And that there's a lot of that goes on, right? Of just finding people that say things that line up with you and amplifying and boosting it. But Qatar generally echoes the U.S. and NATO foreign policy on everything but Israel. And Tucker Carlson has gone beyond that, so I don't see him as working for them, no.
Another question I had along these lines, and I've been kind of having a look at how people on the left have been, and anti-Israel activists have been responding to the Chomsky news. And some of the people, I mean, Aaron Maté is one of the people who jumped out. And I'm not sure what Max Blumenthal and Grey Zone types have been saying, but I'm pretty sure I saw a couple of tweets of Aaron Maté saying, like playing it down or saying, like, I really respect Chomsky and, you know, we can't read too much into this and all this sort of stuff. What's going on there, in your view?
He's kind of this sacred cow that you're not supposed to touch. And also, he's a kingmaker. If he decides to highlight you, that's a boost. And that's kind of why he's been put in that position, right? If Chomsky were to decide to... you know, to highlight and wave around or, you know, endorse, you know, somebody, you know, that would make their career among leftists. And so I think that's part of it. But and part of it is also just for a lot of people. I mean, he was the only one that they ever heard, right? They never, a lot of people who kind of went down the rabbit hole of criticizing U.S. foreign policy, the first voice they ever heard saying very obvious things was Noam Chomsky, because no one else was allowed to say it. So I think there's part of that also. But it's also, again, that kingmaker phenomenon, right? And again, this is part of controlled opposition. It's not simply that they control the narrative, but people who want to advance their careers saying similar things have to negotiate with them, right? And that's, there's a lot of that nonsense that I'm sure you've seen on the right as well, of like, well, somebody gets boosted, they're the famous internet, you know, dissident on the right or on the left. And then everyone who wants to advance has to kind of kiss their ring and get their approval. And that's how these people are able to control the narrative. And Chomsky was able to control the narrative around 9/11. He was able to control the narrative around JFK assassination, around a lot of things. And part of the way he did it was that if you wanted to become a respected or get the credibility of being a leftist critic of foreign policy, you needed to, you know, act in a way that Chomsky would approve of and amplify you. I mean, it's that's kind of how the game is played. So that's what I see all of that being about. And I will say Gray Zone, they have kind of, they've at least Max Blumenthal has been very critical of Chomsky, especially in the aftermath of Epstein, and the way it looks like Chomsky was very much opposing BDS on behalf of Epstein. I mean, he was opposing boycott, divestment, and sanctions at the behest of Epstein. And he was advising Epstein about, you know, how to handle his public relations. I mean, it's pretty awful what we're seeing. I mean, it's pretty inescapable.
Well, just before we finish up here, the book that stayed with me of Chomsky's was Manufacturing Consent. Now, as we discussed before, I was and still am influenced by and interested in Louis Althusser, right? Louis Althusser and ideology and the ideological state apparatus and Gramsci and that whole strain of what you might call structural Marxism, or because I think that's one of the bits that they got quite right. Right, that's one of the strains in Marxist thought that I think is kind of useful, because consent doesn't need to be manufactured. My question is, because it's been 20 years or more since I read that book. Is there actually anything in Chomsky that isn't already there in some of those, you know, greater thinkers in the Marxist canon? Was it just a York notes on what came before, or is it still worth reading in your view?
I mean, it's worth reading in the sense that it will highlight to some degree how thought is controlled and how the gatekeeping is done. But again, there are actual movements out there. I mean, people who built organizations, the Communist Party of the United States, when it was aligned with the Soviet Union, you know, when it was echoing, the Soviet line during the Stalin years, put out lots of great material. And that in the process of, you know, when you talk about Althusser, you talk about Adorno, you talk about the Frankfurt School, all of that, a lot of what those folks were doing were kind of watering down that message and making it less dangerous. I mean, for example, one of the main points of the Marxist, or the cultural Marxist trend, right, that was funded by the CIA, was redefining fascism, right? Marxism and the Stalin-aligned communist movement, there's great books like R. Palm Dutt's Fascism and Social Revolution that show capitalism having this problem of poverty amid plenty and needing mass destruction of productive forces to stabilize itself, and show that fascism arises from the irrational nature of the capitalist system. And fascism is essentially degrowth, right? It's mobilizing to destroy productive forces, to drive down the population, to reboot the economy with mass destruction in an economic crisis. And the Frankfurt School and all of them have said, well, no, fascism is some problem inherent in the human spirit. It's this authoritarianism deep within people that, you know, and they've completely obscured the economic understanding of what fascism really meant, right? So is it true that there's authoritarianism within our souls? Sure. Is it true that that academic institutions and other things are set up in a way that punish people for their thought? And yeah, all of that's true, but you're obscuring the much bigger reality, which is that we have an economic system where poverty is created by abundance. Like, that doesn't make sense. People shouldn't be homeless because there are too many houses. People shouldn't be hungry because there's too much food. But we have an economic system where the more wealth that's created, the poorer people get. And the more technology advances, the more unstable our economy becomes. And that out of that economic system, then there then becomes a need to just forcibly destroy the population with war, destroy the population, drive down living standards and all of that. And that largely leftism has become Malthusian. Right. I mean, leftists want depopulation. Their critique of capitalism. Now, if you listen to a lot of leftist material, their critique of capitalism is they think it produces endless growth. They just think that's somehow bad. And they think growth is bad. They want depopulation to save the planet. And that Marxist economics has been almost, you know, replaced by Malthusian economics. Right. And this belief in overpopulation, this belief in driving down living standards. And so, by talking about fascism as just a problem of conformity, you're obscuring the bigger issue. And that's what I feel like a lot of this kind of soft left, you can call it soft left or manufactured left material, is. It's not that manufacturing consent doesn't say true things. It does say true things, but it says them in a way that you're obscuring bigger realities, right? I think, if I remember correctly, that book really makes a big deal out of East Timor, for example, right? Mm-hmm. The genocide in the island of East Timor. Well, that was carried out by the government of Indonesia, The government of Indonesia came to power in a coup in 1965. Indonesia had a Marxist president, right? And the USA overthrew the government of Indonesia, and just the government of Indonesia, the military overthrew, you know, overthrew the government, and they killed at least 500,000 people. What started out is the CIA gave the list of all the communists in Indonesia to the military, and they just started killing them. But then pretty soon they just started killing whole neighborhoods. It turned into a genocide of ethnically Chinese people. Well, that's not just one little island of East Timor. That was all of Indonesia. So what I mean, East Timor was one island that, yes, the Indonesian U.S.-backed government targeted in one way. But like the bigger crime was the, you know, the atrocities there. And Barack Obama's stepfather was a leader of all of this, was carrying out the genocide, was a leader of the Indonesian military. And Barack Obama was living there as a child. Like he grew up in the Indonesian military, in the household of a military general who was slaughtering entire villages of ethnically Chinese people. There's a much bigger story there. So why is it, okay, it's great to highlight what happened in East Timor. I'm glad that we're acknowledging that the USA backed Indonesia in committing this atrocity on one island. But the all of Indonesia, there was a coup. And prior to that, there was a Marxist government in Indonesia that was aligned with Russia and China that was doing amazing things to raise the living standards and all of that. And the CIA overthrew it. And that story doesn't get told. We just get told, well, our leaders are in America are hypocrites. They say they're against crimes against humanity, and they backed the Indonesian government in committing an atrocity in East Timor. Well, that's all true, but like there's a much bigger story there that we're not getting.
Mm-hmm. That was Suharto, wasn't it? Or Sukarno. I always get Suharto.
Yeah. What one or the other. Yeah. I think Sukarno was the Marxist who was overthrown, and Suharto.
And Suharto was the, just for my own notes, you mentioned that book by the Marxist on fascism and so on. What was the name of that book again?
It's called Fascism and Social Revolution by R. Palm Dutt. I've got it here, actually. It's online. You can get it for free online many places. It was the economic understanding of fascism, a British communist of Indian descent named R. Palm Dutt. He wrote this very, very good book that just shows that fascism is rooted in the breakdown of capitalism. Very, very important text. Yeah.
Yeah. This is why I get Caleb on for friends. I can learn from him. Okay. Well, I think we can kind of tie a bow on it there. There's obviously... I mean, do you think that the Epstein stuff has kind of given some receipts for this notion that you already had of Trump's being controlled or being compromised in some way? I mean, he's clearly engaged in very capitalist activity with Epstein, wasn't he? So,
yeah, I think that there's no question that Trump was compromised to some degree or other. The point is that Trump said very good things. And Americans wanted to vote for him because he said those very good things about opposing U.S. foreign policy, about ending the wars and all of that, and about demanding that the economy be improved, and that the left has stopped saying things like that, which, again, if I had been running the Palestine protests, that would have been that just seems like the obvious message: money and jobs for America, not for Israel. And Trump was more or less saying that. He was saying America first, we're done meddling around the world and all that. And that's what Americans want to hear. Build a movement based on that. That's what we need overwhelmingly. Trump was, you know, a part of the establishment, and he was allowed to emerge. But that dissident MAGA is really, really important. And that's who we need to speak to. And there may have been a time in U.S. history where the left sounded that way, but that time is over. The left is totally controlled. And the way they ran the Palestine protests was just, you know, I mean, it was like they were designed to not reach average Americans. They were designed to alienate Americans. So
just two things before we wrap up here. I mean, one person I've been very disappointed by from the Epstein stuff has actually been Steve Bannon, because to me, he was the figurehead of the dissident MAGA. He was someone who I actually thought was an authentic and genuine expression of what we've been talking about, but he was like in like daily contact with him almost. So that has been very disappointing. The next question I've got is, I mean, it seems to me, reading the tea leaves, that I think MAGA's done. I think we're going to get a Democrat president. Yeah. Do you see any prospect? Because I checked Gavin Newsom's timeline, not a single tweet about Epstein. He was still talking about ICE and stuff like that, the last I checked. Do you see any prospect of the Democrats like changing course or coming good, or, you know, dropping this unconditional support for Israel, or any, like, do you see like a more sensible Democrat party emerging, or are they just hopeless?
The annoying thing about this whole Epstein thing is that there are all these Democrats now talking about it that a year or 2 years ago, if you'd have said Epstein to them, they would have rolled their eyes and said, that's a conspiracy theory. I bet you got that from RT, didn't you? Oh, yeah, Epstein. Oh, yeah, this Jewish guy was bribing everyone and had this mysterious island. That sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory. But now it's something they can use against Trump. And so suddenly Epstein is real, right? And it's like, I'm not here to defend Epstein. I'm just annoyed by the hypocrisy of the whole matter, right? You know, is that, you know, that, yeah, Epstein is real. He's been real the whole time. But there's a layer of people that the Democratic Party is run by this layer of people that they're afraid to think. They're what the Bush people used to be, you know, during the Bush years. They are in the Democratic Party where it's not a matter of if something is true or not. It's a matter of, am I allowed to think this? And arguments can be debunked by saying that sounds like something the bad people might say. Well, that shouldn't be the question. Is it true or not? Right. But until recently, they had the orientation that Epstein didn't exist, that anyone who mentioned it was spreading conspiracy theories and was a right-wing propagandist. But then all of a sudden they were told from the top, oh, Trump is part of Epstein. So now Epstein is real. And it just it's infuriating to watch. But there's similar things on the right, I'm sure. I mean, there are people in the Trump camp that were concerned about it and then were told, oh, don't be, because, you know, we're cheering for Trump. So it's frustrating there. At the end of the day, it's all about the balance of forces. You know, there won't be Democrats wanting to break with Israel until there is a real mass movement really opposing Israel that has real roots among the population that is actually demanding that. At the end of the day, any leader, it's about the balance of forces, and that we need a real anti-imperialist movement with real roots and community in this country. And we don't have that. We do have an expression of the Muslim community, and we do have about a lot of woke protests, but none of those groups really have a base among the population. And if you want to see Democrats or Republicans start to oppose Israel, you need to see some kind of mass movement that has root among the population. That's really the only way it's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the best tweet I ever saw on this was by Shoe on Head. Now, Shoe on Head was this kind of baby-faced girl who was like just a typical anti-woke, anti-SJW type. But she made this tweet sometime last year saying, I've become a single-issue voter, right? Anyone who kisses that wall, I'm not going to vote for them. Right. Anyone who speaks out against it, I will vote for them. To me, that has to be the way at this point.
Yeah.
Because it's beyond a joke at this point. I mean, watching all this stuff come out and watching our media say, you know, all of the evidence in their face and say, oh, well, obviously it's the Russians. It's just embarrassing. It's just embarrassing at this point. It really is. But anyway, this was a fascinating conversation, Caleb. And you're going to be back pretty soon. I'll send you a new link in a second. Right.
All right.
Where can people find you again?
Caleb Maupin, books.net and cpiusa.org, Center for Political Innovation.
I'll just remind people, do buy courses at the Academic Agency, Trivia and the Bestseller there, buy it now. I'll catch you all next time.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.